Welcome to In Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock album.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Today, in the studio, David Gilmour, Nick Mason, and Roger Waters reveal that the blueprint for the most popular double album in the world was actually Pink. It's The Wall by Pink Floyd.
All in all, you're just another brick in the wall.
I finally got so angry that I spat at this child. Well, child, he was 14 or 15, I suppose. And when I came off stage afterwards, I thought, what have I been reduced to here? And what, you know, what has happened to the relationship between the band and the audience? So The Wall was something that I experienced very powerfully through most of that tour, but specifically on that day.
In the studio with Redbeard, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall.
Part one.
What you're about to get are the keys to the adult theme park, a peek behind the curtain of The Wizard of Oz. Pink Floyd's iconic The Wall got the kitchen sink treatment as an immersion box set a few years ago, the big enchilada in the band's multi-tier catalog reissue series, as the top four seller of all time in the U.S. at more than 23 million. And remember, that's a double album. You heard the original album from Pink Floyd, possibly were one of the lucky few to have seen the limited live shows following the late 1979 release, seen the movie of The Wall, starring a pre-Live Aid knighthood by Bob Geldof, heard the historic performance of The Wall by composer Roger Waters and superstar guests at the Brandenburg Gate at the fallen Berlin Wall in July 1990. Roger Waters just concluded a massive Wall tour. We asked Messrs. Waters, drummer Nick Mason, and guitarist-singer David Gilmour what brought them all together in the studio for The Wall. Here's the architect of that musical edifice, Roger Waters, who in 1979 set the Pink Floyd agenda.
I brought a tape. In fact, I bought two tapes to the first listening session, which one was The Wall and the other was The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking. I'd had a rather fertile time, so I was terribly efficient, and I gave folders to the other guys in the band, and we all sat down and listened to these two demo tapes. And I said, I'm going to do one of these as a solo album and we'll do one as a band album, because I was beginning to feel the need to do something on my own. And I gave them the choice, and they quite cleverly chose The Wall.
I don't need no education. I don't need no rising water. Brother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Brother, do you think they'll like the song?
That crude but historic Roger Waters demo tape that he first played for Pink Floyd guitarist, singer David Gilmour and drummer Nick Mason is available now as just some of the myriad of previously unreleased audio and video material in the lavishly packaged immersion box set of The Wall. In November 1979, the curtain was about to fall on the 70s decade, arguably one that had begun in a musical sense with Pink Floyd's 1972 game changer, The Dark Side of the Moon. Now the band was contemplating an ambitious, in some ways outrageous, musical bookend to the 70s, even while punk rockers on both sides of the Atlantic railed that mainstream rock had grown bloated and decadent, leaving fans feeling disconnected from the musicians. Here's David Gilmour.
The stadium tours started in 1973 when Dark Side of the Moon was out. We were doing stadiums immediately, as soon as money got up into the top 10. And it was a major change for us because the audiences just made so much more noise. I mean, we weren't ever exclusively doing stadiums. We would be doing some cities. We would be doing the arenas and multiple nights in arenas in the big cities as well as stadiums. It would be sort of balanced out between the two. But it was quite a shock to the system to be confronted with people down the front all screaming to hear us play Money, when our slightly more reverential audiences, you might say, were sitting in absolute silence waiting to hear the next pin being dropped very, very subtly and delicately from Nick's fingers. I don't recall that the Animals tour was any different really in the way it was done to the Dark Side of the Moon or the Wish You Were Here tours, but it was a bit longer. We toured fairly consistently for 6 months with the Animals tour, and that was a big one for us.
It was Roger Waters' vision that built the wall. His concept, his story, his very personal passion play. Waters wrote most of its music and all of the lyrics.
The idea derived from the theatrical idea of constructing a wall between a rock and roll band and the audience that it was purporting to communicate with. And that idea arose specifically out of the Animals tour. Because we were playing in stadiums almost exclusively for the first time, and it became clear to me after doing one or two from the conversation backstage and from the response in front of the stage and for the things that happened afterwards and from the injuries and the this and the that and the general vibe I got, that this was no longer musicians writing and performing songs. And well, it was, but that was no longer important. What had become important was the gross. It really upset me over a period. We were, playing stadiums for 6 or 7 weeks, and it really started to get to me. And the last one we did was in Montreal in the Olympic Stadium, 90,000 people stretching forever into the distance, chain link fencing in front of the stage, kids on apparently on some kind of Pavlovian dog trip of screaming their heads off from the moment that we appeared on stage till the moment we left. Nobody listening. Well, not nobody. I'm sure there were a lot of people in the audience who were trying to listen. Very difficult for an audience to pay attention to what's going on. And what was important, and I've been to lots of stadium shows since, and with the exception, I think, of Live Aid, they're all the same. What's important, is the demagogy, is the worship of the very rich people. Rich in terms of having earned a lot of money, but also maybe rich in terms of the way the audience perceives how it must be to have written such and such a song or to be that popular or whatever. It's the worship of idols from afar, and I find it distressing.
Thank you. expected to see. If you wanna find out what's behind these cold eyes, you'll just have to claw your way through this disguise. Nice.
Roger Waters.
So, at the end of this Montreal show, I found myself, there was some kid trying to climb up the chain link fencing. I got so angry with this kid who was screaming all through, I don't know, Mother, or one of the quieter songs, anyway. I finally got so angry that I spat at this child. Well, child, he was 14 or 15, I suppose. And when I came off stage afterwards, I thought, what have I been reduced to here? And what, you know, what has happened to the relationship between the band and the audience? So the wall was something that I experienced very powerfully through most of that tour, but specifically on that day. So at that point, I thought, well, if I ever go out on the road again, because I was very sorely tempted never to do it again, there are two things. One, I will never play in a big stadium again because I think it's wrong. It's not the right place for rock and roll to be. It's only about greed and ego. And two, I need to express these feelings about how I feel about the breakdown of whatever between me and the audience. And so that was really the start of the wall.
Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason, followed by David Gilmour.
Something about the way The Wall was recorded, which is what was quite interesting about it, particularly sort of looking back to things like Animals prior to that, where we'd really done it virtually all ourselves. We'd done quite a lot of the engineering ourselves. It was produced in-house and so on. One of the interesting things looking back on The Wall was that the jump we managed to make that time was to go out and find other people to bring in and help. Thinking particularly of Bob Ezrin as producer and James Guthrie as engineer, we really tried to take a sort of new look at the way we worked. When I think it was a good choice, I mean a good thing to do at the time. Just sort of thinking back to some of that, it was very different to the way we'd worked previously.
Certainly think that we wanted to make a move forward, and we were feeling the need to break out of the smallness of our circle, if you like, a little bit, and get some other opinions and minds on it, if you like. And it was a significant, a good move for us, I think, to do that.
There's a common misconception that the well-publicized fracturing of Pink Floyd occurred at some time after the Wall album, tour, and movie. But in a previous episode of In the Studio about the 1975 Pink Floyd album Wish You Were Here, Roger Waters revealed to me that, quote, already the rot had set in. So Waters found in co-producer Bob Ezrin a creative arbitrator.
He would be prepared to argue with me about things. He's articulate enough to be, you know, it's no good arguing with me in the studio and saying, I don't like that. You know, you've got to explain to me why you don't like it and why we should do it a different way or make a suggestion or whatever, you know. And Bob is articulate and quite able to do that. So we had a good, lively relationship making the record. He was a very good musical and intellectual sounding board for me, because he's very bright and he's quite tough as well, and so we could sit and talk about what it was about ad nauseam, which was absolutely invaluable because I don't think anybody else in the band had any idea of what it was about, and I don't think they were very interested. In fact, I know they weren't interested. And so that was one thing. He also brought a discipline to the production of the record. He would sit in the studio for hour after hour with Nick trying to get the drum tracks in time, and eventually did. And so he provided the record with a pocket, you know, a rhythmic kind of pocket within which the songs could sit and be listenable to.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song? Mother, do you think they'll try to break my balls?
Mother, will she tell your little boy apart? check out all your girlfriends for you. Mama won't let anyone dirty get through. Mama's gonna wait up until you get in. Mama will always find out where you've been. Mama's gonna keep baby healthy and clean. Ooh, baby.
Roger Waters sings the verses and David Gilmour sings the bridge and chorus on Mother from the Wall. Next, Waters, Gilmour, and Nick Mason return to reveal the many sources of the cinematic sounds that enhance the Wall's music. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Roger Waters, David Gilmour, and Nick Mason for the anniversary of Pink Floyd's The Wall, Part 1.
In the studio with Redbeard, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall,
Part 1.
Thank you, guys. We're inspecting the conception, design, and building of Pink Floyd's The Wall. It's important to note that the themes Roger Waters explores here, alienation and madness, were not new ones for him. His bleak visions of a society in 1979 losing touch with itself had clearly permeated Pink Floyd's Animals album 2 years earlier. As Pink Floyd grew into superstars, as the audiences and profits grew larger and larger, Roger Waters found himself feeling isolated, out of touch, cut off from the real world, cut off from himself. For Waters, that emotional barrier, that personal wall, was real, and it was frightening to him. I asked if now he realizes that it's a universal human dilemma.
I think everybody does, yeah. It's just that, happily, some people's walls are smaller than others. I think mine was a big one. In fact, actually, I think an awful lot of people's walls are enormous and insurmountable, and they never, ever get past them. I don't know what they do. They become, armed robbers or politicians, or they may stay completely in the depths, and what would appear to us to be the kind of dregs of society, and hang around on street corners mugging people, or they may equally rise to positions of great power. They're the dangerous ones, the ones that are cut off but are nevertheless in positions of some political power. I think we all know people who would do a better job as president of the United States than Ronald Reagan or George Bush, but they don't become president of the United States because they wouldn't touch the position with a barge pole, because they're more humane than that, and they can't, and they're not prepared to waste all the energy that you have to waste in lying and cheating and going to committee meetings and kissing babies and shaking hands and all that crap that those people have to go through in order to achieve the positions of power that they eventually do, or that some of them do. So the flaw in democracy is that the guy who is going to work hard enough to get your vote is almost inevitably and invariably not the right man to vote for. It's a paradox, I think.
Dad is flown across the ocean. Leaving just a memory. A snapshot in the family album. What else did you leave for me? Daddy, what'd you leave behind for me? All in all, it was just a brick in the wall.
I know that rock and roll has some impact because I get the letters, you know? And when I get the letters, it makes me happy. From an audience point of view, I know it's a good way of communicating human feelings to other people, because I look at the body of Neil Young's work over the years. I'm just kind of really glad that this genre exists and that there are people of that kind of quality and depth creating stuff in spite of all the changing fads and fashions. And it gives me a little kind of tingle of satisfaction down my spine to know that some people look upon me in the same way that I look upon him or John Lennon.
The Wall, like many of Pink Floyd's albums, is punctuated with ambient sounds, jarring noises, pieces of conversations, the noise of television shows, and the stunningly real sound of helicopters. Roger Waters says those helicopter sounds were recorded at an airport near Los Angeles by engineer Brian Christian.
Brian also smashed the TV set wearing goggles, you know, and with a sort of sledgehammer, and that was in the parking lot of Producer's Workshop in LA. He went to Burbank and he recorded, I think it's a Jet Ranger, and he did it with a Sennheiser gun mic, and that's the sound, and he did a great job. It's a really nice track. In fact, Kate Bush, a couple of years ago, wanted to use a helicopter on one of her records, and she tried to record helicopters and couldn't. She rang up and asked me if she could use that sound effect and could I give it to her, and I said, sure, just give the band a credit on the record and you're welcome to it, and send her a copy of it over. And she used it, I believe. I'm not sure which record it was, but I believe she used it. So Brian did that.
Oh,
Pink Floyd performed The Wall, including Another Brick in the Wall, at London's Earl's Court in 1980, and the entire 2-CD remastered performance is included in the massive Immersion 7-disc box set. Here's Roger Waters.
Most people perceived Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 as an attack upon education and teachers, and which it wasn't at all. It was a part of a large story of my autobiography, if you like, but it was never meant as a broad attack upon education, because education is obviously very important. An educated human being is often... I was going to say he's often happier than an uneducated one, but of course that's not true at all. But I think if you live in an urban environment, it is necessary to know a bit about a lot of things if you're going to make any sense of it and work out how you can be happy.
Ironically, this album, Roger Waters' attack on the dark side of rock stardom, yielded Pink Floyd's first number one single, Another Brick in the Wall Part 2. Waters' diatribe against cruel, sarcastic teachers featured the voices of some actual schoolchildren, recorded in London by engineer Nick Griffiths.
We sent him a multi-track tape over from LA, and I spoke to him on the phone, will you do this? I want you to get some kids in and do this. And he went, all right, I'll do that. And so he went into the studio on his own in London and put the kids on Another Brick too. And I'll never forget this multi-track arriving back at Producer's Workshop in LA by a courier. I got it out of the box and said, put this on. And they put it onto the multi-track. And we just pushed all the faders up to kind of halfway up and played it without any mixing at all. And I remember the first time I heard it go by, shivers going down my spine. I thought, well, this is fantastic. Islington Green School, it was called. And it's a primary school, so it's from kids aged 6 to 11. And it was the local school where the Pink Floyd studio was in North London. It's a kind of working class neighbourhood, sort of half and half, black and white kids, and a not very well off neighbourhood. And of course they came in and they rather liked this song. They thought it was quite good. And so they sang it with, under Nick's direction, they sang it with great gusto, and I thought the result was just marvellous. And as soon as I heard it, I said, that is the single.
Look, Mummy, there's an aeroplane up in the sky.
Goodbye.
The song Goodbye Blue Sky by Pink Floyd features the languid lead vocal of David Gilmour. Still to come, Gilmour, Nick Mason, and Roger Waters confess that at the time of making The Wall, they were broke. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Roger Waters, David Gilmour, and Nick Mason, Pink Floyd's The Wall, Part 1.
In the studio with Redbeard, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall,
Part 1.
Thanks again, gentlemen. The recording sessions for The Wall were spread over 8 months, 4 studios, and 2 continents, one each in New York City and Los Angeles, and 2 studios in the south of France. In fact, the British version of the IRS, called The Revenue, was one of the financial considerations that dictated such international studio hopping. Roger Waters makes another surprising revelation.
Well, we were going to do it in London, and then we had an extraordinary reverse in that we had channeled a lot of money into a company in London who was supposed to be investing it and so forth, and unfortunately they stole it all instead. But they stole it in a way that the revenue in England still wanted us to pay tax on it. So 5 years after Dark Side of the Moon, we were completely skint. Having got this piece of work that looked as if it might be a good one, we decided reluctantly to go and make the record in the south of France. But I confess that the reasons for making the record in the south of France were purely for the fear of being broke.
What shall we do to fill empty spaces where we used to talk? How shall I fill the final places? How should I complete
calling. Are we reaching? See, he keeps hanging up. Then it's a man answering.
According to Roger Waters, that's a candid recording of an actual telephone operator there on Young Lust from Pink Floyd's The Wall.
That's the best bit in terms of the theatre of the record. I'll tell you what happened. I wanted to get across somehow that the guy's calling his wife and she's got a lover. So I thought, well, how about if I ring up the operator and ask an operator to call this number collect in London and tell her that I'm calling my wife and have I prearranged that somebody in London would pick the phone up and say hello, and then when he heard collect call for Mrs. Floyd from Mr. Floyd, will you accept the charges, just hang up. And then I would keep asking this person and the lady who is on the record was only the second operator I tried. The first one didn't get it at all. But this second one, who is on the record, her imagination just went berserk, and she immediately realised that my wife was having an affair with somebody else. And all that stuff of, and it's a man answering, and is there supposed to be anybody else there? She did. That was just this woman getting excited about the thought that she was listening to the breakdown of a marriage going on.
There's a tasty medley of the musical themes from The Wall, arranged and performed in fanfare live at London's Earl's Court in 1980. It's not on The Wall studio original, but now remastered as part of the Immersion box set. Next week at this same time, you'll learn from Roger Waters, Nick Mason, and David Gilmour how The Wall rose to number one sales worldwide, won a Grammy Award, and went on to be the number two selling original album in history at 23 million copies in the U.S. alone. We'll be right back. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests David Gilmour, Nick Mason, and Roger Waters. All three return with me this same time and day next week. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find a whole lot more from Pink Floyd and others when you visit inthestudio.net.